Here's a new way college students and professors are doing research. It's called Mechanical Turk. It's a website run by Amazon, the same Amazon that delivers everything from books to toiletries. Let's say you need 200 smokers to take a survey on lung cancer, or you have a moral dilemma to pose for a paper on Kierkegaard. You can log in, offer a few pennies to each participant, and watch the data roll in. NPR's Gabriella Emanuel explains.
MechanicalTurk.com. Okay, so the page that loads is full of these gray rectangles. Each one is a different task. Right here at the top, there's one out of UCLA. They're paying 25 cents for a 5-minute survey on consumer decision making. The next one is 10 cents, and it's about dating preferences. Let's scroll down and see what else we can find. Okay, here's one from Ohio State, paying 50 cents for workers to fill out a survey about their political beliefs.
It's very efficient, it's very fast, it's very cheap.
That's Adam Barinsky, a professor at MIT. He studies public opinion, and some of those gray rectangles are his studies and surveys.
I mean, there's been a huge explosion. So about 4 years ago, not a lot of folks were doing it, but now everyone I talk to at conferences is doing that.
It all started about a decade ago. Amazon had a problem. It has millions of web pages, each with a product for sale, but some were identical. The company wanted to weed out those duplicates. This is hard for computers to do, but easy for people. So Amazon offered to pay people a few cents to do it for them. Soon other companies were posting tasks too, and Mechanical Turk was born. Why the name? Well, it references a famous hoax from the 1700s. There was this chess-playing machine that could beat everyone, but it actually was a chess master hiding inside. So too with Mechanical Turk. It seems like a computer is doing the work, but it's actually a person.
I do between 6 to 8 hours and earn about $20 a day.
Anna Vasquez is unemployed, but between job interviews, she Turks from her Brooklyn apartment. She does the math.
$2.50 an hour, which is basically, I guess, waitressing without the tips.
Mechanical Turk, or MTurk, as it's called, has sometimes been criticized as a digital sweatshop. Vasquez knows the pay is peanuts, but she really wants a job in social services.
I'm enjoying the flexibility to keep pursuing that and not have to, like, say, choose something right now because I need the money.
So she's strategic. There are lots of different tasks on MTurk, Googling websites to boost their rating, transcribing, copy editing. But she says research studies pay the most.
Recently, I did one on memory, and it just involved, you know, clicking different numbers on the screen. It's probably for someone's PhD or something like that.
Quite likely. Jonathan Phillips is a PhD student at Yale. He uses MTurk all the time. Compared to what he did before, he says it's a dream. He used to print out questionnaires and hit the street.
You'd spend like 2 to 3 hours before you got too exhausted to continue, and you'd get 15, 20 responses. And it's just so painstaking.
But now,
you come up with a study, and then like an hour later, you have 200 responses, which is pretty fundamentally different.
Barinsky, over at MIT, says researchers save
not just weeks of effort, but great amounts of money as well.
He's paying a couple cents per participant. That's compared to the $10 or $15 he used to pay. Okay, so MTurk is fast and cheap, but is it good? Are the data they're getting reliable? The research shows the population of Turkers is pretty representative, more so than signing up college students. There are other benefits, too.
I think it's actually improved the extent to which we can really be sure about our results.
From his tucked away office, Phillips gives me an example. Say you put up a survey, but the wording isn't quite right. That could skew the findings.
People are much more willing to say, well, I didn't really like that you used that one word there, so can you just change it and rerun on a Mechanical Turk, knowing that it's not going to take you that long.
MIT's Barinsky has another upside.
It's enabled people to take more chances, to do things that might seem crazy or sound crazy, but are really clever and interesting and turn out to be right.
So what about the downsides? Maybe it's made research too easy and too cheap. Barinsky says some scholars might be throwing up bad surveys.
Maybe it would be better if people had invested a little more of their own money before they ran with an idea.
And not all research is suited to Mechanical Turk. If your study involves children, that's a no-go. Need to observe your subject's facial expressions? Can't do that on MTurk. Those researchers can, of course, just do their research the old-fashioned way. But Jonathan Phillips worries some researchers are shying away from tough topics.
I don't think we have any good sense of exactly, you know, which questions are now being neglected because they're harder to study. But I think it'd be crazy to deny that it's having an influence on which questions we ask and how we ask them.
And there's another change underway. We think about academics toiling away in cubicles or sterile laboratories. I spoke with one of Barinsky's colleagues. He surveys American voters on MTurk, but he does it from Indonesia. He might even be on the beach. Gabriella Emanuel, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
And let's return to a subject we talked about in our business segment yesterday, ultra-secure smartphones. In the wake of the Edward Snowden NSA data gathering scandal, there's been a lot of public outrage about privacy, or lack of. But are people willing to pay more to maintain privacy? A new smartphone out this week might help answer that question. It's called Blackphone, and KQED's Arthi Shahani met its maker in San Francisco.
Mike Janke used to be a Navy SEAL sniper. Today, he's taking on the government and corporate America.
We know we're creating enemies, but we're okay with that because this is the right thing to do.
Janke is founder of Blackphone. The slim device is in fact black, with rounded curves and lighter weight than my Samsung Galaxy.
It's actually faster than your Samsung and an iPhone. It's benchmarking 12% faster than both of those.
Blackphone's main selling point is privacy. It's not NSA-proof in that everything is hackable if you try hard enough. But Jenke says it's taking on the entire mobile economy that lets law enforcement and companies in way too easily. Take apps that look free but mine your data to earn hundreds and thousands of dollars. Facebook tries to get your contacts. Google Maps tries to get your geolocation. Pandora gets your music preferences. Blackphone has a default setting.
No, no, no.
Unless you proactively choose yes. Blackphone also rebels against smartphone norms. Say you want to spend Sunday afternoon lost in a coffee shop or a clothing store. You might think you're off the grid, but your phone, using Wi-Fi, is talking to beacons.
Finding out where you've been, making offerings to you, what Blackphone does, it'll automatically stop that beacon to protect you from those type of stalking things.
In addition to hiding identity, Blackphone stores user data in a secure vault in Switzerland, kind of like those no-questions-asked Swiss bank accounts. It sounds like the digital equivalent of wearing sunglasses and a trench coat everywhere. So I ask the obvious follow-up question. Is it mostly for criminals?
No. Certainly because of the summer of Snowden. It's about 20 to 25% of the world is really the people that are concerned about security, really concerned about their privacy.
Boeing is creating a smartphone for defense customers that's called just Black. Blackphone is the first big push to bring military-grade privacy to everyday consumers. It starts shipping this summer and sells for $629, less than the latest iPhone. But not all privacy buffs are lining up to buy. I go to a data security conference in town and meet up with David Duncan, chief marketing officer with the anti-spyware company Webroot.
Well, Webroot is available from the Google Play Store for free, and Webroot provides a lot of the security functionality from an application perspective, parts of the security functionality that are available on a Blackphone.
Many products do help shield smartphones from data mooching, but Blackphone is unique in that it encrypts text messages and even voice calls between users in the network. Still, Duncan says, that's not such added value. Wireless carriers will still keep records of internet IP addresses you call from, and when you call out of network, they keep the phone numbers too.
That's all been in the public record with my cellular communications provider for many, many years.
Maybe he's a tough sell. So I wander around and talk to at least 50 people. Just about every conversation goes like this one with Rick Riggle and Candace Kika.
Are either of you guys going to buy that new smartphone called Blackphone? It's supposed to keep all your data safe.
Blackphone? No, I never heard of that.
Haven't heard of it. I have the iPhone 5, though, with the fingerprint.
Blackphone makers plan to sell 2.5 million phones this year. Let's see if they can hit that goal without reverting to the snooping and stalking tricks of the trade. For NPR News, I'm Arthi Shahani in San Francisco.
A new survey finds that nearly a third of full-time employees do most of their work remotely. That includes work done not only at home, but anywhere outside one's regular office. The study also looks at who teleworks. As NPR's Jennifer Ludden reports, the finding may surprise you. When I say remote worker, who do you picture? Maybe a harried mom in her bathrobe? A millennial at a coffee shop? Wrong, says workplace flexibility strategist Callie Williams-Yost.
A remote worker, someone who does most of their work outside of their employer's location, is not a woman, is not a parent, and is not a Gen Y millennial.
In fact, the study she commissioned finds 3 out of 4 remote workers are men, of all ages, just as likely to have kids as not. Yost and others attribute part of this gender gap to the kind of work women are more likely to do, jobs that can't be done remotely, think teachers and nurses. Her study also finds women are much more likely to work in a cubby or open office space rather than a private office.
And those cubicle open office space workers were significantly more likely to say that they did not increase or improve their flexibility last year for fear of being perceived as not working hard and fear it will hurt their career.
To test this, I walk into a Starbucks near my home in Washington. There in the back is a middle-aged man with a grande and a laptop.
I do have an office, but I do most of my writing in coffee shops.
Michael Gerson is a columnist who writes for the Washington Post, but even when he was head of speech writing with a nice office at the White House, he says he often worked at Starbucks.
When you're in the office, people are asking you to do things. When you're at the Starbucks, you're both with people but isolated and can actually get things done.
So telework helps people escape the chaos of the office. But what about that modern quest to balance the conflicting chaos of work and family?
For most people, most of the time, telecommuting is simply a facilitator of longer work hours.
Jennifer Glass of the University of Texas at Austin studied thousands of teleworkers over 2 decades. She found that for most, that remote work was overtime, above and beyond the at least 40 hours they'd put in at the office.
We tend to give people autonomy and control over their work hours as they ascend the career ladder and get in more and more upper-level positions of responsibility. The problem with that is that the work hours also increase. So all that flexibility is really just about where you're going to do your 80 hours of work per week.
Glass has also found that when workers ask for a flexible work schedule, managers are far more likely to say yes to men and no to women. All this helps explain a conundrum experts see. Remote work and flexible hours may be more popular and accepted than ever, but they still seem hardest to get for those who need them the most. Jennifer Ludden, NPR News.
Xavier Ruffin was excited for the 2007 premiere of Mad Men. Ruffin was a young graphic designer, and here was a show about his world.
I wanted to be a fan of it when it first came out. I just had my own personal differences, not liking the way that blacks were represented in their universe. I just couldn't get over it.
Instead of getting over it, he decided to create his own series, Mad Black Men.
Welcome to the Colored Marketing Department.
The new web series just premiered on the video sharing site Dailymotion. In the famous animated opening sequence to Mad Men, a silhouetted figure walks into an office which falls apart, pieces tumbling to the ground.
I just took a different approach to it and said, okay, so if the furniture falls down, someone has to clean it back up because every episode it falls down again. So one of our characters, Rufus, who is both the janitor and Colored Campaign's accountant.
What the?
He comes in and cleans up the mess. And he has a little quip to say every time.
I ain't cleaning this up twice.
Mad Men, of course, takes place in the world of Sterling Cooper and focuses on the lead character, Don Draper.
Our world is kind of like a parallel universe of sorts. So we're at Sterling Copper, that's Sterling without the G. And our protagonist is Ron Rapper, who's, a hotshot ad executive, making a name for himself in the New York scene. It's just that when he shows up to places, people are thrown off by the fact that he is non-white.
There was a misprint in the ad. We already have a custodian, thank you.
I'm sorry, you may have misunderstood me. I am here for the more lucrative position.
Security, this is Judy. You're needed on the 21st floor. Yeah, thank you.
Wait a minute.
We should explain how this is set up because this is not sort of like a Funny or Die kind of web parody. You do it with sort of high production values. It looks like it could be of that time period. And there are jokes there, but it's generally played kind of straight.
Yeah, it's more of a dramedy than it is like a Naked Gun 33 and a third type of parody, because I feel like that's what's really popular on the internet right now. What I wanted to do is kind of cater to people who were interested in Mad Men, and I wanted to give them a different lens to look at that universe through. I did want to be a bit funny, maybe a little bit more silly than what Mad Men is, just to admit that we're poking fun at something.
Which brings us to the world of the mad black men. Basically, we have the main character, Ron Rapper, who's brought in to head the colored marketing department. And they basically work out of a broom closet.
Yes, this is true. Basically, they're working on what this ad agency feels are minority-specific clientele. So the first client that they're working with is Mississippi Melons.
I want you to make the lips and the nose a lot bigger. Because right now our character isn't black enough. And
so they're working on these racially insensitive campaigns that are being handed down to them by just racially insensitive bosses.
Now, Matt Weiner, who created Mad Men, he's been criticized for not having more black people on the show. He said that basically there were no black people in advertising back then, and there still aren't to this day. How do you respond to that?
There are black people in advertising. There have been black people in advertising. There isn't a great amount of representation, but we do exist and we are here.
So on the show, on the Mad Men show in recent seasons, there's been a bigger role for Dawn, the black woman who's the secretary of Don Draper. But there's been nobody of color on the creative side. Who are some of the black advertising creatives that you look up to?
All right. Well, the first person that comes to mind is George Olden, who was a very high-profile figure in the 1960s. He actually designed the Clio Award that Don wins in season 4.
Huh.
And, like, he won way more than Don ever won.
Wow.
Caroline Jones, whose story actually mirrors Peggy Olson. She was a secretary who became a copywriter who ended up owning her own firm. So, yeah, there's more than just a few people of color that were working and operating at a high capacity during the Mad Men era.
So the final season of Mad Men is going to be kicking off in April, but you've just got started on Mad Black Men. So where are you going to go from here? Where do you want to take this?
Well, I can't divulge those secrets just yet, but we do have right now a 5-season arc planned out. We've been looking into different real life figures that we could model Ron's career trajectory after. Ron could have a great career, or Ron could go the wayside, because you never know as a black man. It's real. Anything could happen at any time.
Xavier Ruffin is a graphic designer and the creator of a new web spoof called Mad Black Men. Thanks for your time today. Great talking with you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Short films have been around for as long as there have been movies. In fact, the very first movies were shorts. This year, 15 short films have been nominated for Academy Awards. For a long time, actually seeing these films, for most people, was all but impossible. As NPR's Netta Ulaby reports, this is no longer the case.
If you, an ordinary non-Academy member, wanted to see an Oscar-nominated short a few years ago, you couldn't. Not unless you lived in a city with an art house theater that happened to be showing them. Now, if you want to see the Oscar-nominated shorts like Mr. Hublot, an animated gem about a steampunk Paris filled with mechanical Victorian gadgetry, Mr. Hublot is a single man. All you have to do is download them on iTunes or Amazon, or you can watch them on video on demand. They're also playing in more than 400 theaters across the country. The Oscar-nominated shorts have become an increasingly hot ticket.
Since 2006, we've probably had over an 800% increase in box office.
That's Carter Pilcher, president of Shorts HD, a company dedicated to making shorts more accessible.
Short films used to be kind of out there and nobody saw them. I would say The technology has caught up with the content.
Now we have YouTube. It's created an insatiable appetite for short, easily digestible chunks of content, ones we can watch on our mobile devices. And over the past 15 years, shorts have been redefined by Pixar. It's hard to remember now, but Pixar used to be mainly a hardware company, teetering on bankruptcy. Its owner, one Steve Jobs, hired someone to show off what its animation technology could do. That someone, John Lasseter, thought, why not shorts? He created one about a trembling little toy tormented by an oversized, sadistic baby. Scientists and engineers gave that short, Tin Toy, a standing ovation in 1988 at a computer graphics conference, says Pilcher.
And because of that short, they were able to go on and make and get financial backing for big ones.
Namely, Toy Story, directed by John Lasseter. Since 1998, every Pixar movie in theaters has been shown with little shorts. They're fun, they add buzz, and for years, Pixar's shorts division was run by Osnat Shur.
We think of them a little bit like an hors d'oeuvre before the main course.
Or a digestif after. Now Shur works for Walt Disney Animation Studios, where, as at so many other media companies, shorts have become a trendy way to try things out.
The stakes are a little lower. You have permission to take greater risks in shorts.
With technology, ideas, and people. At Disney Animation Studios, Shur says, everyone in the company gets to pitch ideas for shorts, from the president to the janitor. This year's Oscar-nominated short from Disney was originally proposed by a story artist.
Make way for the future!
You've seen Get a Horse if you've seen the movie Frozen. It takes some of the oldest existing animated footage of Mickey Mouse, complete with voicing from Walt Disney, and throws just about every kind of new technology imaginable into the mix, says Osnat Shur.
With Get a Horse, I have never seen anybody break barriers between 2D, CG, and 3D, all within one shot.
Shorts are also a way for filmmakers to gather feedback, explore tertiary characters, and hype other projects. There's also something liberating about shorts that's not limited to animation. Nick Reed felt freed by the idea that his movie could be just as long as it needed to be.
My feeling was that I wanted to make a film that when you finished it, that you went, I want more.
Reed produced the Oscar-nominated short documentary, The Lady in Number 6, Music Saved My Life. It's about Alice Hertz Sommer, a Holocaust survivor who lived to be 110. She died this week. Sommer was a musician in the Theresienstadt concentration camp.
With music, I was always happy. I am happy even without music. Even thinking of music made me happy.
As amazing as she is, my fear was if you make it a 90-minute or a 2-hour film, you lose the power.
And because shorts don't need to fit into some sort of predetermined format, it's being shown along with all the other shorts on the Shorts HD channel that reaches 30 million people worldwide. In the U.S., it's on DirecTV and UVerse. Not surprisingly, the channel's popular in France and Romania, where the company says it's one of the most watched movie channels in the country. Netta Ulibi, NPR News.
Now we'd like to turn to Venezuela, where violent protests have filled the streets for 2 weeks now, a story that may have been overshadowed in this country somewhat by the turmoil in Ukraine. The unrest is putting a spotlight on President Nicolas Maduro and the country's economic problems. We wanted to hear more, so we've called Andrew Rosati. He's a freelance journalist based in Caracas, Venezuela, and he's with us from there now. Welcome back, Andrew. Thanks so much for joining us again.
Thank you.
So what are you seeing today?
Well, today it's a lot calmer than it was yesterday. Yesterday there was big rallies here, and students try to take the highway, and what they do is often they'll try and block transit for the rest of the city in a form of peaceful protests. But that usually is met by the National Guards, and rocks get thrown, and tear gas and rubber bullets come out, and it gets pretty ugly here. And that's what enveloped most of the eastern side of the city yesterday. At least 5 people were injured, and there's big clouds of tear gas and rubber bullets bouncing all over the east side.
Bring us up to date for people who haven't been following the situation there. What set this off? I mean, is there a common thread now between those who are protesting and people who are joining the protests and so forth?
Yeah, the whole protest movement is centered around student groups that began in the western side of the country for an attempted rape on a student on a western university campus. And that kind of spiraled to to a list of grievances that are bothering the country. And then about 2 weeks ago, they got backing by a politician by the name of Leopoldo Lopez. And everyone was kind of, as participating in this program, is blaming the government for a slew of issues like soaring crime, which started everything, sky-high inflation, a basic shortage of basic consumer goods. And people now on the streets, what we're seeing is a big difference in message from what started the protest, and they just really want the president to step down. They want the government to be held accountable for all the problems facing the country, and they really feel, a lot of them, that the only way to solve these problems is a change of government.
You know, Maduro was Hugo Chavez's handpicked successor. Is he not able to retain any of the authority or goodwill or support that Chavez had built up over time? You know, what's happened to what should have been his base?
Well, I mean, he still has a considerable base. Maduro won the election by a very slim margin, but just over, was just under 2 percentage points. And the Chavista movement and the government won the municipality elections last December by with over 50% of the popular vote for their candidates. But unlike Chavez, Maduro hasn't been able to win over a lot of the opposition forces. Chavez always succeeded in getting a lot of people in the middle ground, that with his charisma and the way he kind of made people laugh here and directed the country. People never really held Chavez accountable the same way they're holding accountable Nicolas Maduro. And Chavez was able to kind of blame it on its ministers or blame it on the U.S., but people don't believe Maduro anymore.
What is Maduro doing in response to this? I mean, you've mentioned that there's been obviously, you know, police, you know, a military response, which is not being appreciated, you know, by the protesters. So clearly, what's been Maduro's response? What can you point us to in the next couple of weeks to sort of see how he's going to handle this?
Well, it's been, in my opinion, a lot of heavy-handed tactics in form of the on behalf of the government. The government claims that these student groups and opposition circles that support them are conspiring with Colombian forces and the U.S. government to topple his 10-month old administration, and that, in the view of a lot of people here, are ignoring that the government is ignoring what they're asking for entirely. But more recently, as the death toll has risen, there's been at least 16 people killed surrounding these protests. The government is saying he wants dialogue. However, the opposition don't think he's serious about it. They think the government's being disingenuous, and they have yet to accept this invitation.
Andrew Rosati is a freelance journalist based in Caracas, Venezuela, and we reached him there. Andrew, thanks so much for joining us.
Always a pleasure.